Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. But this isn't going to be just about mind power. It's going to be mind power in the sense that you will have information that you can research and study, but it's also going to help you have body power. Now, that may sound a little odd and a little strange, but my guest today, Dr. Erno Daniel, is a man who's been deeply involved for a good portion of his medical career in research, in studying why do conditions evolve in a person that can be debilitating? What is going on? His book is Stealth Germs in Your Body, How Hidden Infectious Organisms Can Jeopardize Your Health. Dr. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this. I was so impressed with your publication, because number one, you wrote it so that a lay person like myself can read it and not feel like we're in a quagmire of medical technicalities that just cause us to go brain dead. But you wrote it because you really wanted people to have an understanding that a lot of conditions actually evolve because of bacteria and viruses. Now, I want my audience to know a little bit about you. You're a member of the Department of Internal Medicine at the Sansom Clinic in Santa Barbara. You have in the past held an appointment as a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Southern California School of Medicine. You're medical director of Vista Del Monte Retirement Community, medical advisor of Mission Terrace Convalescent Hospital, and member of the Medical and Scientific Advisory Board of the Center for Cognitive Fitness and Innovative Therapies in Santa Barbara. You were elected Fellow of the American College of Physicians. You're listed in the 1996 and 1998 editions of the Best Doctors in America in the Pacific region. Also, you were listed in an edition of the Consumers Research Council of America's Guide to America's Top Physicians. Well, you've got quite a wonderful listing of accomplishments, Doctor, but I'll tell you what, I was impressed with your publication, and
yeah.
I think that this is so significant. What caused you to decide you needed to investigate this aspect, which most medical people would say is a bunch of hooey?
Well, a couple of things. One is, with all my background in science, I'm still primarily practicing physician. And if I think back or add up the numbers, I've actually sat down probably 150,000 times with patients as part of patient office visits. So I've been in practice over 30 years. And over time, it became obvious that many patients who were told that they have some diagnosis, such as irritable bowel syndrome or menstrual problems, whatever, in fact, turned out to have a treatable condition, which was an underlying infectious condition. And sometimes the clue was something simple, such as the patient was given antibiotics for their sinus infection, and the patient noted that their stomach symptoms improved or their pelvic symptoms improved, giving a clue that maybe there was a separate infection somewhere else that also was cured with the same antibiotic. And then it became clear that some of these patients had been treated for irritable bowel syndrome or something else for a considerable period of time, and nobody thought that they had an infection, because just like a bladder infection or even a common sinus infection, you usually don't have fever or chills, mm-hmm. which would give us the clue. And so therefore, not only patients don't ask, well, gee, could my irritable bowel syndrome be due to an infection, even the doctor won't think of it.
Mm-hmm. Very true. I like your statement, and I'm going to quote it directly from your book. Medicine is a science. Medical diagnosis and treatment are an art. This book is one diagnostician's view of the art of diagnosing conditions caused by stealth infections. to gain a full and complete perspective. It will be helpful for you to understand the concepts of infection, how medical diagnoses are made, and how to participate in the diagnostic process. But we're going to go on to some other things. What is a stealth infection? Give us a little bit of information on that.
Yeah, so stealth infections as such are not in the usual medical textbooks. I basically adopted that term in order to bring the issue to attention that there is a subgroup of infectious organisms that don't give you the classic fever, chills, redness, swelling that most people would associate with the concept of infection. This subgroup of germs can enter the body more quietly with relatively little disturbance. A person may not feel well for a few days. They feel like they have a little case of the flu, and then the symptoms go away. And then considerable time later is when some smoldering symptoms emerge, and by then the person wouldn't think of the infectious agent as being a possible cause. Classic ones are, for example, hepatitis C. Either after sexual transmission or intravenous infusion, hepatitis C enters the body. Very little in the way of symptoms. Many years later, liver chemistries are slightly elevated. And then 30, 40 years later, liver cancer emerges. And all of a sudden, it turns out it was all due to this hepatitis C that entered the bloodstream and the liver. Many other infectious organisms are now implicated in various conditions, and one of the remarkable things is that probably up to 20% of cancers worldwide are due to infections. Nobel Prize went recently for discovery of the link between the papillomavirus and cancer of the cervix, and the fact you can get a vaccine against the papillomavirus, which will likely eliminate a good bit of cancer of the cervix, because cancer of the cervix is, in fact, mostly triggered by this particular viral infection.
Amazing. And that was particularly significant to me because I had been diagnosed with dysplasia, which is the precursor to cervical cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, I ended up going through two surgeries because they, you know, removed that. So here you have something, and I'm just putting myself out there, just stating this is a fact. And I can remember what I went through with the physicians that were talking about it, and they had, that was the last thing that was even considered. This, I mean, what you're doing right now in putting this book out is bringing some information to the forefront that, again, I don't think there's enough questioning of a patient or asking them of their background. A lot of people, if they're not sick very often, they may not have much of a background when they go in to see a physician, but this is critical. This is something that's very, very important. So if someone is found where they have these conditions, where they look at it, I mean, you even bring it out that some of this is caused for heart conditions.
Yes, so the book, as you have mentioned, is really intended for the general readership and actually is intended to be more or less of a self-help book for patients in all walks of life. The problem with medical information is that oftentimes, as you mentioned, is in the scientific form, which is all full of medical jargon that's hard to understand for patients. Plus, when they go into a doctor's office, oftentimes the interview is fairly fast-paced. The doctor may interrupt the patient within less than half a minute to try to clarify something, and then the mainstream of information gets derailed.
Mm-hmm.
So my purpose with the book was to also have chapters on how doctors are supposed to process information and how the patient can bring the information in a form that will naturally dovetail with the doctor's diagnostic efforts. And the back of the book, as you may have noted, has a worksheet where which is for the patient to organize information and actually ask very specific questions from the doctor, and even ask the doctor to sign on the bottom as to what the doctor's opinion is as to what the diagnosis is, and that really forces the doctor to think through as to whether they're really right or not.
Well, I just think it's marvelous. Some specific areas of information, which I will share with my audience, really hit home. There are two members in my family that have died of stomach cancer. One was a male, the other was a female. The male had served time over in Vietnam and as a young man had been exposed to an infectious series of conditions. And when he died this last December, almost a year ago, then I knew immediately that this was related to what he had experienced. And this is a man who's in his 60s, but what he had experienced many years ago when he was 19 or 20 years of age, I believe had a very strong effect on the condition that he died from. Then there was another member of the family, a female, who had had a series of situations during her life. She wasn't a hypochondriac, but she ended up having stomach cancer. And it was, I think, stimulated by a number of different physiological conditions that she had experienced through her years of living. And she was also in her 60s when this hit. Then there's something you mentioned regarding the ear and how people can have sudden hearing loss. And I know of a woman who, she's long since gone, but I remember listening to her telling her stories about flying B-52s and how she had lost a lot of her hearing that way. And then she got a cold, was given a medicine, and her total hearing was wiped out. Mm-hmm. And you talk about herpes viruses and how they can affect hearing, all kinds of things. This book is absolutely a gold mine of information, giving people options to work with instead of feeling like there's just no real answers. How was it that there was that development? Was it particular equipment that you were able to acquire that allowed you to see these stealth germs?
Interestingly not. I first of all, again, appreciate your enthusiasm about the topic. I feel equally passionate. I believe there are large numbers of individuals out there who have chronic ongoing symptoms and are told that they have some non-curable condition, yet their condition may actually be curable.
Mm-hmm.
Medical diagnosis is really not, it's partly technology dependent, but mostly it's still detective work. And a good detective doesn't rely just on fingerprints. A good detective thinks through everything and processes all the information and thinks of all the possible questions and angles. And that's what makes a shrewd detective, somebody who puts together the information and doesn't just fall into the trap of saying, well, gee, a fingerprint was here, so that must be, yeah, that mm-hmm. must be the culprit. Medical diagnosis is complex, and it depends, and the analogy I use in the book is, it's like trying to guess the title to a movie. If a person has had lifelong medical problems, the best way of getting a diagnosis is to assemble all of that information in sequence. It all started when I was 20 years old, was in Vietnam, had a stomach infection, then I got mm-hmm. dysentery, then I was treated, then I got malaria, then I got vaccinated, then this improved, that didn't improve, then several years later I had my appendix out. And if you really watch that whole sequence, you eventually get the feeling for what the problem really must have been. If you only look at a short segment of it, the person comes in and says, look, I have irritable bowel syndrome right now, and you ignore everything that went before, you may get a very partial answer and you may come up with a wrong diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that that's the key, that doctors really need to look at the entire history of someone's illness, and then they need to be aware of, you know, what possible explanations there are. As you mentioned, there are some diseases right now where, you know, viruses implicated. There was an article in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings in November, that's literally just within the last week or two, discussing the role of herpes virus 6 as being a trigger for multiple sclerosis. I mentioned that in the chapter in the book because there had been mm-hmm. some evolving information, and this is not the final answer, but herpes viruses can be treated with Valtrex or acyclovir, the same thing that we take for cold sores or shingles. And if so, when the person first gets this viral infection, maybe if they were promptly treated with this antiviral, the multiple sclerosis may never happen at a later time. Now, that's totally preliminary information, and it's far from being proven, but I believe that the mistake is that sometimes simple infections are neglected because they don't seem to be causing much trouble and they're disappearing by themselves. Yet, if they get stuck in the system, that's when they cause trouble. And syphilis used to be the old classic, where you just get a minor little skin sore in the genital area that would resolve by itself, and you would have hardly any symptoms until decades later when you would get arthritis and skin rashes and even dementia, and it was due to this smoldering bacteria that was still in the system.
And no fever, no symptoms that, you know, in any way could be discerned. Now, you have a story in here about some African villagers, and there was a bladder parasite, which I don't even know that I can pronounce it, but it's a schistosomiasis?
Yeah, schistosomiasis, yes.
And it was absolutely amazing to me because boys particularly were affected by it. And so many boys were affected by this, it was considered normal for them to have periodic bleeding. And they didn't realize that they were carrying this serious infection. It had been going on for generations.
That's correct. And they just pick it up from the local water supply and people get infected. And again, that's another one. If that stays in your system for many years, eventually you do get cancer. You may get cancer of the bladder from having this chronic low-grade infection in your system. So the remarkable thing with the human body is that to some degree it does adjust to certain infections and keeps these infections at bay. But that doesn't mean that these infections are totally harmless. I mean, the classic one that all of us carry is the chickenpox virus. Almost all of us have had chickenpox when we're little. And then after having the chickenpox, we feel perfectly fine for several decades, and then at age 70, we get a case of shingles. And as it turns out, it's the same infectious organism that sat in the system for many decades, then suddenly erupts and can cause a rather unpleasant and perhaps even, you know, sort of pathologic eruption, where if it actually erupts in the eye or in the, you know, near the face, it can actually affect the vision and cause these terrible post-herpetic pain syndromes. So here's a germ that can sit for decades and all of a sudden erupt and then cause illness. Now, the interesting thing is that only about 10 to 15% of people who've ever had chickenpox will get the shingles eruption. So how come 85% of everybody never gets any trouble from this germ, even though it's in their system, and 15 to 20% get some problem from it? How come? And, you know, who would we need to treat? Well, there's a shingles vaccine available now to reduce the chance of getting a shingles eruption. But it's still remarkable that a lot of people actually handle these viruses and they don't ever have any problem from it. But 15 to 20% of everybody who gets a reaction, I mean, that's a huge number. And if every virus that ever got into our system causes illness in 15 to 20% of us, then we really need to be aware of those connections.
Absolutely. Now, one of the many points, there's a lot of good information in your book, you talk about poor dental hygiene, that if you don't have good hygiene, then it can cause cardiovascular and kidney diseases. We're filled with germs. There's just no way. It always bothers me when someone says, gee whiz, go in for colonics and, you know, strip everything out of your system. No, the human body is so complex. We have so many life forms living within ourselves. That's how I'll describe it. And a lot of it keeps us healthy. When it goes wacky, then we have problems. But this with the teeth, I found interesting. I wouldn't have expected it to be related to the kidney and to the heart. How can that be? What is it that comes from that area of the body?
Yeah, so, you know, that's a very interesting topic. Of course, the simple direct connection is when one has teeth cleaned, oftentimes there'll be a little bit of bleeding. And so that more or less indicates that the bacteria that are around the gums and in the mouth can actually enter the bloodstream pretty readily because the blood vessels are so close to the surface that they will even bleed when the teeth are cleaned. Mm-hmm. So if one has artificial valves inside the heart, for example, from surgery, or perhaps artificial knee joints or hip joints, these bacteria that temporarily get seeded into the bloodstream during dental work, or vigorous teeth brushing, or vigorous flossing, you know, can mm-hmm. actually circulate for a few rounds. Most healthy individuals, again, the immune system clears these few bacteria very readily, but in patients who have these artificial substances inside their system, some of the bacteria may get stuck on the artificial surfaces and then overgrow and infect the heart valve or infect an artificial joint. So that's the most direct connection, and that's why patients who've had these artificial implants are told to take antibiotics, you know, for a single dose before they have dental work. Now, the indirect connection is we may remember childhood nephritis from, you know, many years ago. It doesn't happen very often, but you get a strep throat and then you get nephritis. So the body also mounts an immune reaction to certain organisms, and it's this immune reaction is what may cause problems. So in the kidneys, one may get a kidney reaction to a distant infection because the body's immunity is reacting vigorously to some infection that's elsewhere in the body. As far as the cardiovascular system goes, chlamydia is an organism that's hugely underestimated. It's in partly sexually transmitted, but there are forms of chlamydia that one gets from pneumonia forms or through the lungs. Even birds have a chlamydia-like organism that one may get from bird cages and being around birds and all of that. And these chlamydia have a propensity to get inside one's system. Certainly in women in the pelvic area, chlamydial infections are rather common. And they then find their way into the bloodstream. And there is some evidence that in plaques within the arteries, there may be chlamydia organisms, and that these are the ones that cause inflamed plaques. And if there's already some cholesterol plaques, this inflammation or infection with the chlamydia is what may destabilize the plaque, which is then the mechanism for throwing a blood clot, so to speak, or peeling off one of these plaques and having a coronary event.
Very interesting. Now, let's take a different positioning. Let's say that someone wants to find out if they have a condition, and you go into a lot of detail in your book relative to various conditions. What kind of tests can be run, if any, to find out about this? Now, you talk about finding a good diagnostician. I have a member of my family that went in to see a doctor, hasn't been to a doctor for years, and ended up developing walking pneumonia, so they go in to see a doctor. And they were really upset because the doctor just was adamant that you've got this problem, you've got this problem. He was saying, wait a minute, I can't breathe. I've got pneumonia. And this doctor wasn't paying attention to anything that was going on. And then we ended up getting a call where they said, guess what? We looked at your x-rays. You do have pneumonia. You just wanted to take a skillet and go whack, whack. But regardless, this physician wasn't asking questions. When I talked to this member of family, it was like they were making assumptions and putting this individual into a little box.
You know, unfortunately, what you describe happens more often than the medical profession would like to admit or like to, we all would like to think of ourselves as being careful, science-based, people who do solve problems methodically and just as best as we can. But a couple of things happen. One is in fast-paced environments, sometimes physicians try to get a few clues and then try to jump to a conclusion. And in the book, I also talk about it. It's sort of akin to hearing a few notes of a song and then trying to guess the title to the song. And some doctors actually try to take pride in how quickly they can do that. You know, give me three clues mm-hmm. and I'll tell you what you have. And sometimes patients also think that the best doctors are the ones who can be given three, four clues, and boy, the doctor is just making a diagnosis. What a brilliant guy this must be.
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective, it really is much more the careful detective that's a good diagnostician, and that's a little bit time-consuming, but not necessarily if it's done methodically. And that's the reason I encourage patients to actually bring a very short little concise summary of their symptoms, because sometimes in talking with a doctor, things get fast-paced and then some important information isn't presented, whereas that may be the key evidence. Whereas if it's presented verbally but also backed up with a little note which describes the symptoms in sequence, you know, there's a better chance of getting an accurate diagnosis. Now, testing-wise, in the chapter on how diagnoses are made or missed, I do write out a number of tests that can be done. Ultimately, it's still the doctor's thought process that will make the diagnosis using various clues. But if someone suspects a low-grade infection, there are numbers such as sedimentation rate, C-reactive protein, serum protein electrophoresis. These are sort of nonspecific tests that are blood tests that are not necessarily done commonly because, again, doctors don't necessarily think of infections as even being a possibility in some of these conditions, such as multiple sclerosis or irritable bowel syndrome or chronic menstrual cramping. But if any of these blood tests show some clue that the body's inflammatory processes are working on something, then further testing could be asked for. And there are some fancy scans, white blood cell scans, but ultimately it's still going to a good diagnostician who's willing to sit down and look at the information and add it all up and then come to an accurate conclusion. Unfortunately, 15% of the time, the diagnosis that somebody is given may not be accurate. There are some diagnosticians who have a lot better record, but on the average, some doctors still try to jump to a conclusion too fast.
Well, I agree. Doctor, we're going to be taking a break in just a moment. Would you be able to stay with me for another 15 minutes?
I'm very happy to do so, and thanks again for having me on your program.
Well, it's just a delight. We're going to be taking a break for a moment. I'm talking with Dr. Erno Daniel. The subject is stealth germs in your body. Now, this is written in a way that you as an individual can understand it. The average layperson will be able to comprehend what is here. So, again, it's important for you to be knowledgeable. When we come back, we've got more things to share with you, so don't go away. This is Donna Sebo. We'll take a break for just a moment, and we'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hello, this is Donna, and my guest today is Dr. Erno Daniel. The book is Stealth Germs in Your Body, How Hidden Infectious Organisms Can Jeopardize Your Health. Now, this information has been around to one degree or another for a lot of years, but I think Dr. Daniel has finally found a way to reach the average person saying, pay attention, this is something that you can do some investigative work with a good diagnostician. Now, Doctor, while we were off the air, I was talking about how difficult it was to find someone that would actually listen when you go in to talk to them, and we discussed this a little bit. Can you make a recommendation about how to find a diagnostician who would be willing, one, to listen, and two, that you can develop a relationship with? Because I think that this is so important. We're all very individual in our body chemistry, our blood types, and this is just so frustrating that it's sort of like being out on a cattle farm and the cows are being herded into the pen and everybody's treated the same. It doesn't work that way. What can we do?
Oh, boy, you raise a difficult dilemma because, all physicians are also of different varieties and different temperaments. And there really isn't any way of knowing from even somebody's credentials as to whether they are really a thoughtful diagnostician. And interestingly, even though the House program says that Dr. House is the chairman of or the member of the Department of Diagnostic Medicine at his hospital, there really is no such department in any university medical centers. Diagnostic medicine is not sort of a recognized specialty, even though in my estimation it should be, because that's the most important thing. We need to make the diagnosis. Treatment is very easy once we know what we're treating.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, I think most physicians can be good diagnosticians if they are kind of given the opportunity. Physicians sometimes worry that when a patient comes in with a complicated problem, they will ramble, and that's why they try to slow down or interrupt the patient. So again, if a person comes in very organized, then, with a little concise timeline and worksheet, I think they have a much better chance of getting a diagnosis. It's sort of like going to court. If somebody goes into court and gets up in front of the judge and starts rambling, they get sort of tuned out or dismissed very rapidly, where if somebody comes in very organized with a concise little notes and says, look, judge, here's the problem, this is where it started, this is what happened, then this was the next thing, this was the conclusion, this is what happened when I tried the following, they're much more likely to get a hearing and get the right answer and the right conclusion.
Well, I wish there was an easier way to do this, because with the cost of medical care, it is hair-raising. I mean, when you get a bill for a doctor that's almost $400 and he spent only 15 minutes with you, that's a little unsettling. So, and people say, oh, well, check with this list or that list or the other list. And it's a tough one. It really, really is. And I know that you deal with mature patients. You're a geriatric specialist, and that is even more complicated to deal with. Let's talk about a few things here that you have in your book, and I'm just pulling these out at random. You talk about reactive arthritis after an unnamed virus exposure, and I think of how many people, I have a sister-in-law who has had arthritis. My goodness, it's just hideous to see what's happened to her. And thinking of this as perhaps having a bacterial infectious base with this and how she has been crippled with it, it's just amazing. And her whole life, her whole career, everything was destroyed because she has very, very severe arthritis. It's just absolutely amazing. And you say it's caused by a parvovirus B19. Now, it's not the only one that can do this, but this is giving a name to something that nobody's even seen before.
Yes. So, look, there's actually some exciting information on the reactive arthritis front that came out very recently. There's some publications about a subtype of arthritis called Reiter's syndrome. That's R-E-I-T-E-R apostrophe S syndrome, Reiter's syndrome. It's been known for quite some time that if you get salmonella infection or a chlamydia infection, again, a sexually transmitted disease, chlamydia, that one can develop sort of a reactive arthritis where the joints get inflamed for a period of time, and some of this can become a spinal arthritis. They took a group of these individuals who have had this arthritis, and again, once the initial exposure occurs, there's no more fever, chills, only the arthritis. Only the arthritis is treated. The symptoms are treated, but the infection is no longer considered to be part of it. Well, they took a group of individuals who had had this arthritis for 8.5 years, and they were on arthritis remedies being treated. They then put them on antibiotics and got a 20% cure rate of these patients who had had this 8.5-year-long disease, which was, you know, where they were told it's non-curable or non-fixable. So some patients with arthritis, again, not all, this is, you know, still, you know, a small subgroup, are potentially curable by being given a couple of weeks' worth of an antibiotic, because actually the smoldering active infection is still part of the driving force.
Mm-hmm.
Another 60% actually had at least a response to the antibiotics. They weren't cured, but there was close to a 20% cure rate. Now, rheumatoid arthritis, that's still less directly known, but parvovirus B19 that's written up in the book does trigger in patients a rheumatoid arthritis-like reaction, and the initial presentation is mistaken for rheumatoid arthritis, yet it's an active viral infection. The problem then is what happens afterwards. Is the virus still active, or is the virus long gone already, and we are really just left with the inflammatory arthritis? From Reiter's syndrome, it appears that in some cases the viruses or the organism is still active in the system driving the arthritic condition. The problem is that for parvovirus B19, there's no real good treatment, though investigational infusion of immune globulins can actually sometimes knock down the virus. And again, I think what we need to be aware of is if we catch the infection, which is a known potential trigger for something, and if we catch it early, if we think of it as being the potential trigger and then neutralize it very early rather than jumping to the conclusion, oh gosh, this patient has rheumatoid arthritis, if you would say, oh no, you have parvovirus B19 infection that looks like it's going to evolve into rheumatoid arthritis, and if we treated that infection very promptly at the very beginning, the patient may not have a full-blown case of rheumatoid arthritis later or a much lesser course of rheumatoid arthritis later on. And that's a new concept, and that's far from being in practice, but I'm encouraging, you know, my colleagues and everyone else to think in that way, because I think information will show that that will be probably, eventually accepted as being the mechanism for the development of many, many diseases.
I know that you also have a commentary in here about leukemia, and so many people get it. I was not aware, other than in cats, that animals, they have found in animals a number of different viruses have caused leukemia in animals, but they've not made the connection as far as people go. I mean, I've talked to researchers that say what happens in dogs and cats and animals happens often with people, so there's this cross research that's done. Why do you think they didn't, or they ignored the fact that this could be the very thing that could be causing leukemia?
Well, you know, medicine, interestingly, is science-based, and so therefore nothing will be accepted unless it's more or less proven beyond shadow of a doubt. The slight advantage of being in medical practice is that medical practice is more engineering, where we don't necessarily have to have absolute proof of every last equation being written out. if we get a clue to some response, we can oftentimes act on it and use our best judgment. And that's how the ulcer bacteria diagnosis came to being. That a couple of physicians who were in practice in Australia noted this phenomenon, that patients who had chronic stomach problems were treated for diverticulitis or a sinus infection. They came back and said, "Geez, doc, you know, my stomach feels all better. It hasn't felt this well in years." And they accepted that as a clue. That was not absolute scientific proof by any means, but that was a very useful clue. And once they heard that 15 times, they said, you know, must be something to it. And then they acted on it. And then finally they did the science experiment that verified it. It's the same way with leukemias. If you just go in the laboratory and look for viruses in the blood of patients who have leukemia, you may not get this kind of a clue. And also you may not be willing to say anything unless you've proven it 100% that yes, this virus causes this particular disease. So just because we have hunches that that may be true, it doesn't get into the textbook, so therefore it's not so.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe that many cases of lymphoma, leukemia are probably infection-driven, and one mechanism that I talk about in the book is the concept of dual infections. In medical school, we learned that kids in Africa who get mononucleosis actually get Burkitt's lymphoma. So the mononucleosis transforms into this malignancy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why should mono give you cancer in Africa and not give you cancer in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the concept is dual infections. If you actually have two or three different significant infections in your system, you'll have a very significantly worse outcome with any one of those infections. So we know that if you carry hepatitis C and then you get malaria on top of that, you get 10 times as sick as if you didn't have, you know, the other infection. So that's it. That leukemia, for example, it's possible that those who get leukemia may carry two different germs. Maybe they have H. pylori in their stomach. Maybe they have chlamydia in their pelvis. Maybe they have cytomegalovirus in their bloodstream, and then get the leukemia virus, and now they have two, three infections, and that's why that individual will get leukemia from this particular virus, and the other people who just got the germ by itself never get leukemia.
I know that there are so many children that end up with it. There are a lot of adults that do. And I can remember being told by someone many years ago that sometimes cancer is even contagious, relatively. And when you think of it, just from what you've presented, there are those factors that things can be transmitted from one person to another, because we're dealing with virus, we're dealing with bacteria, we're dealing with these incredibly adaptive forms of life. That's how I will describe it. And we live in a world that's so complex with a body mechanism. The human body is just, to me, an absolutely awesome miracle as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I'm just awed by what it does. And the fact that so many of us survive is just amazing. And with the information that you've given in your book, Stealth Germs in Your Body, How Hidden Infectious Organisms Can Jeopardize Your Health, I think that it at least gives people some information to work with. And then your details in the back of what you recommend when you go in to see a doctor, explanation of terms, all of this is so very, very useful. Dr. Daniel, do you have a website that people can go to where they can find out even more about your book and your work?
Yes, the stealthgerms.com website gives at least basic information and directions about some of what's in the book, and a little bit of information about myself. So www.stealthgerms.com.
All right. Well, it has been a pleasure having you as a guest. Thank you for staying with me so we could chat a little bit more. And for those of you listening, we're going to be taking a break, but I really want to encourage you, if you want to be more knowledgeable about your own wellness, this is a book that you can add to your library. You read it, and I think it will surprise you how much you will learn. And that can be a step forward for you. It'll also give you ammunition when you go to the doctor. So don't be afraid to take on something that's a bit unique, like Stealth Germs in Your Body. It's a good thing to have. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break for just a moment. Dr. Daniel, again, thank you for being my guest today. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna, and telephone lines are open, though for a short time, 888-815-9756, if you would like to chat with me. Now, I wanted to let you know who's coming on next week. How warm it was and how far. Dr. Robert Kahn is going to be sharing a very special story with us on Monday. Then on Tuesday, we're going to be talking turkey. Yes, this is the month for Thanksgiving. And I think that you will enjoy Leo Pearlstein. This is a gentleman that's been a guest on my show before, and we talk about wonderful recipes. And seventh inning, Karen Lowry is going to be talking about her son and how she worked with him as well as a school system to be able to make some things happen for her little boy. Emptying the nest. Oh, have any of you adults that have kids that you want out of the nest or you want to prepare them for being on their own? I think you'll enjoy Brad Sachs and what he has to say. And then Unplugged Video Game Addiction. Ryan Van Cleve is my guest. This is an amazing story. It gives you an inside track on how people do get addicted to video games and what the results can be. I have just was amazed when I found out about it. Well, I got this cute little story and I thought, I'm going to share it with you. It came from Robin. She said, a young man named John received a parrot as a gift. The parrot had a very bad attitude and an even worse vocabulary. Every word out of this bird's mouth was rude, obnoxious, and laced with profanity. John tried and tried to change the bird's attitude by consistently saying only polite words, playing soft music, and anything else he could think of to clean up this bird's bad vocabulary. Finally, John got fed up. He yelled at the parrot. The parrot yelled back. John shook the parrot, and the parrot got angrier and even more rude. John, in desperation, threw up his hand, grabbed the bird, and put him in the freezer. For a few minutes, the parrot squawked and just screamed. Then, all of a sudden, it was very, very quiet. Not a peep was heard for over a minute. Now, John quickly opened up the door to the freezer. He thought he had hurt the bird, which he didn't want to do. The parrot calmly stepped out onto John's outstretched arms and said, I believe I may have offended you with my rude language and actions. I'm sincerely remorseful for my inappropriate transgressions, and I fully intend to do everything I can to correct my rude and unforgivable behavior. Well, you can imagine, John was absolutely stunned at the change of the bird's attitude and what the bird had to say. And just as John was about to ask the parrot what had made such a dramatic change in his behavior, the bird spoke very softly. May I ask what the turkey did? I know it's corny, but I like it. Anyway, Donna Sebo here at 888-815-9756. I promised you that I'd give you the last four astrological signs of Celtic astrology. And here are the dates. September 2nd through 29th, you are a swan. Now, if you've missed the previous shows, and all this week I was giving this information about the different zodiacal signs in Celtic astrology, this is, I've got four signs left, and I'm going to be sharing these last four. So it's September the 2nd through December the 23rd. So if you're born between the 2nd and 29th, the animal symbol in Celtic astrology is swan. You're wonderfully eloquent. You are very, very conscious of how you present yourself. You are very, very discriminating in everything, whether it's regarding your home decor or the people you choose to surround yourself, whatever. You really like refinement, and some may see you as somewhat detached, but you just are someone that is composed and in a class of your own. In fact, if you study swans, they're very, very loyal, and they're very, very passionate about those that they are close to. And so it apparently seems to apply to those of you born during that time. Those born between September 30th and October the 27th, you're cheerful. Why? You're a butterfly. That's right. Cheerful, magnetic. It is a social creature, the butterfly. And that's why many times people born during this time period are called a social butterfly. The Celts saw the butterfly as representing transformation and rebirth. People like to be around you when they're down in the dumps because they know that your good disposition is going to have them smiling in no time. You're gentle, you're empathetic, and you love life. And you don't have problems keeping yourself involved with a lot of social activities. October 28th to November the 24th, you're a wolf. That's right, a beautiful wolf. You are known to be fearless and brave. You have the heart of a warrior, especially when it comes to those that you care about. And you'd risk everything for the people that you love. And once you've made up your mind about something, it's almost impossible to get you to change your mind. And in many ways, the sign of the leader and protector is very, very strong during that time of the year. November 25th through December 23rd, well, you're a high flyer. You are a falcon. You are able to focus on long-term projections and have a keen eye for observing what needs to be noticed. And once you have something in your sights, well, I'll tell you, you're rather tenacious. Nothing stops you. You can be an unmovable force that will not be turned away from the primary objective. You're smart, you're a little bit crafty, and you're always wanting to get as much information as you possibly can. So if someone steps on your toes, they're going to have to be aware of the fact that you're going to make sure that they know they stepped on your toes, and then some. This is Donna Sebo. That is the end of all of the zodiac information, and it was all due to the Celtic culture and what they related to the individual under different signs. So if you're a deer, you're a cat, an adder, a fox, a bull, a seahorse, a wren, a salmon, a horse, a swan, a butterfly, a wolf, a falcon. Just keep in mind, you're part of this very special experience that we call life, and live it to the hilt, because that is what life is all about, living with purpose and with passion. This is Donna Sebo. I'm so glad you've been able to join me today. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Never stop learning. There's always something new, something interesting and intriguing that you yourself can become aware of. Life is a constant set of changing circumstances, I should say, and that is always going to be the way it is. Sometimes we think that we would like for the world to stop for a while, or for life to stop for a while so we can catch our breath. Well, you can stop for a while if you want, but I guarantee you, you're going to find that even when you have those pauses, you're going to be able to come out of those pauses with even more enthusiasm. Life is rich with opportunity. Always remember that. This is the now, and it's what you do with the now that creates your future. Donna Sebo here. We'll be back, same time, same place, right here on BBS Radio. Talk to you on Monday. Have an awesome weekend. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.